open the House Committee on Business and Labor, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Consent Bill 81.
Mr. Chair, Committee Member, Senate Bill 81 expands the types of performance security that the Lottery Commission may accept from a lottery contractor and specifies that the amount of performance security must be acceptable to the Commission and permits a surety bond to be issued by entities or individuals. The bill came out unanimously from both the Senate Education and General Government Committee and the Senate.
Larry Niswender and Mary Bray, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
Whenever you're ready.
Yeah. Chair Soffler and committee members, for the record, my name is Larry Niswender. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Lottery. I'm accompanied today by Mary Bray, who is the Contracts Officer for the Oregon Lottery. We're here to just provide some brief testimony on Senate Bill 81A, which is basically a housekeeping bill, and to address any questions you may have. I've provided committee staff with a copy of the testimony for you. Basically, the bill is to update an existing law that lottery operates under, whereby we are required for our major procurements to have those vendors post a performance bond, and it is the only form of security that the law currently allows. Well, the proposal in 81A is to allow us to broaden that statute and to make it current with public contracting laws that have changed since our laws were adopted. It is a hindrance to the conduct of lottery business, and we have had to do numerous things to work around that law. What we'd like to do is have it updated so that it allows other types of securities, such as letters of credit, certified checks, and cash deposits. And these items are more secure, more effective, and less expensive. So they actually provide us with more security, which is the purpose behind it in the first place. So we think it'll be good for us as well as those that do business with the lottery, and we would like your support. And we're here to answer any questions you may have.
Have anything to say?
No.
Yep. Okay. Representative Esquivel.
Question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question. What happens if I, as a vendor, put in a cash deposit to what you just mentioned? Who gets the interest off that, and where does it go? Does it go into a trust account, or what does it go into?
Chair and Representative Esquivel, we do hold those in trust, and we do accumulate interest on those while we have them in deposit, yes.
But who gets the interest?
State of Oregon.
But it's my money.
Well, yes. I may have to back up. If we have an actual time certificate, check of deposit, we may actually just hold it in physical custody, and it's usually for a relatively short time. But if it's... depends on the type of instrument it is.
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe you could get back.
I will.
Let me know that, please.
Any further questions for these good people? Alrighty then. Well, thank you very much. Would anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 81 today? We have another one for the lottery right after this.
Yes, please.
So just stay where you are. Obviously, they're way ahead of me. All right. Well, seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 81 and open a work session on Senate Bill 81 and entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 81A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron, move Senate Bill 81A to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. Members, it passed unanimously in the Senate. Seems pretty straightforward. Does this merit the consent calendar? All right, very good. So be it then. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 83.
Mr. Chair, can we double start?
No.
Okay. Senate Bill 83 exempts state lottery devices, game devices, from federal law, which prohibits the transportation of gambling devices.
Very good.
Yes, the Chair, Software and Committee members, once again, for the record, Larry Niswender, Deputy Director at Oregon Lottery, provided a copy of an outline of the concept, let's say, bill before you, as well as a copy of the federal law that's referenced in that bill. Lottery does consider this pretty much another housekeeping bill. When ORS 215 and 2.217 were adopted, it was when video lottery began. And the statute as it's currently constructed only exempted video lottery terminals from laws restricting their transport. And so it was very narrowly worded, and the creators were focused obviously on the introduction of video lottery terminals at that time. Upon recent review by the Department of Justice, they made a recommendation to us that we really should broaden that exemption from federal law for the transport of gaming devices beyond video lottery terminals. We have other machines in the marketplace that we haven't been questioned about moving in-state or out-of-state the purchase and disposal, but we want to be proactive and actually make this exclusion to cover other things, such as Keno machines that you're probably familiar with and see in retailer establishments around the state. The federal law allows us to be exempt from restrictions on transport as long as the state has a law that does, in fact, allow us to do that. So that's where we're trying to just make that minor change to the law. We also have the second minor thing in the bill is to take two slightly different terms that are used in the bill, video lottery terminal and video lottery game terminal, and we would like to make those terms consistently used. And so you'll see in Section 4, Sub 4, I believe it's on page 2 of the bill, where the word game is inserted. And that's just for us to be consistent, avoid inconsistencies and question. And again, while we're in those two sets of law, we thought we would take care of both those issues at the same time. There is no fiscal impact to the bill, there is no revenue impact, and there is no known opposition to the bill. And we welcome any questions you might have about these two changes.
Only a comment before I open it up to questions. I wish the federal government gave the state this flexibility on logging and water use. That would be very helpful for this community.
We can pass along.
Yeah. Any questions of these good people?
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
just an editorial comment. While I think the bill probably has merit, I won't be supporting it. Years ago, I opposed the introduction of video lottery, and in Ways and Means Sub on Human Resources, we found that there are about 75,000 Oregonians addicted to gambling. 70% of those are addicted to video lottery, which is state-sponsored gambling. And just on principle, I oppose this kind of thing.
Representative, I appreciate your opposition. If I could wind back the clock, I
yep.
wouldn't do this either. But this state is hooked on this stuff like heroin.
Yeah, and we're addicted as well, and I am.
Right.
Addicted
to but I money. Appreciate your sentiment, believe me. Any other comments or questions for these good people? Representative.
Mr. Chair, maybe I missed it. Thanks, Larry, for being here today. The in or insert, what was the purpose of that?
Actually,
in
that
a couple
one,
of different places?
That one actually is was a housekeeping change that was proposed by legislative council. It wasn't something we specifically asked for. It just, they said they thought it was necessary just to make clarification about whether devices were only in or on the premises. I couldn't answer for legislative council other than they said it was just a housekeeping change they thought was necessary.
Trying to visualize.
And play video poker on the premises
or
in
the premises.
Too bad they won't let us log in or on federal property. Representative Barton.
No, I wasn't raising my hand, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
Oh, forgive me. Any further questions or comments? Would anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 83 today? All right. Seeing none, I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 83 and open a work session on Senate Bill 83. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 83 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron, move Senate Bill 83 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We have opposition registered from our friend down at the end there. Is there any other comments or questions on the bill? We have one in opposition. Is there any other opposition? Can we just say Representative Kennemer's voice is opposition and leave it at that?
That's fine, Mr. Chairman.
All right, very good. Thank you very much. Seeing no other opposition than our friend at the end there, I'm going to...
Carry.
Oh, who wants to carry this bill? Since Representative Kennemer is opposed, I think someone should carry it. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry it? Representative Esquel, you're always there for me. Thank you. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 83.
Let the gentleman carry it.
I'm willing to carry it.
Hey, if you want to, it's fine with me. Anyway, now we probably better not do that. Okay.
I think you're supposed to have a proponent.
Yeah, that would probably be best. I don't want the department out there pulling their hair out.
I'm not a real proponent, but I'll carry
so, it. And I think I look forward to those comments. I think I'll speak to it myself because we are... Anyway. So just go right down the line here.
Yes.
I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 135A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 135A authorizes the Liquor Control Commission to authorize the import of distilled liquor ordered by and en route to the commission by certificate of approval and also authorizes the commission to establish qualifications for the certificate of approval via administrative rule. The measure passed unanimously out of both the Senate Business and Transportation Committee and the Senate as a whole.
Thank you, Teresa. Mr. Paul Romaine and Mr. Thomas Irwin, please. Whoever wants to go first.
I always defer to the youngins.
I need to put my glasses on, sir.
I can appreciate that.
Not quite young enough.
Not that young.
Huh? Yesterday I had a Band-Aid on my chin, and then during subcommittee, my glasses broke, so I had to tape them on, and I had tape glasses and a Band-Aid. I was looking good.
You were a thing of beauty.
As always. Thank you for recognizing that, Representative. All right, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tom Irwin. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The commission is bringing before you Senate Bill 135A in gross today. 135 proposes to require an out-of-state manufacturer of distilled spirits to obtain a certificate of approval to ship their product to the state of Oregon, to OLCC. Such a certificate would create a jurisdictional mechanism that the state could use to enforce its financial assistance laws when violated by an out-of-state manufacturer of distilled spirits. To give you some background about this, Oregon... ORS 471-398, which has to do with financial assistance laws, prohibits manufacturers or wholesalers from providing money or other items of value to retailers of their products. Financial assistance is prohibited to prevent manufacturers and wholesalers from exerting undue influence over retailers' sales practices. These practices could create unfair promotion of alcoholic products and may result in potential overservice of those products. Currently, OLCC has authority over all in-state manufacturers of distilled spirits, beer, and wine, as well as out-of-state manufacturers of beer and wine, either through licensure or certificates of authority. This authority allows the OLCC enforcement of the financial assistance laws, and the missing link is jurisdiction over out-of-state manufacturers of distilled spirits. The OLCC has uncovered instances of financial assistance violations involving manufacturers, their agents, and licensed retailers. These violations include payments to some retailers for promoting the manufacturer's products. Because the OLCC lacks a jurisdictional hold over out-of-state manufacturers of distilled spirits, the OLCC cannot enforce Oregon's financial assistance laws against manufacturers importing distilled spirits into Oregon. The most likely mechanism for gaining jurisdiction to enforce Oregon's financial assistance laws against out-of-state manufacturers of distilled spirits is to require them to obtain a certificate of distilled spirits into Oregon. OLCC can act against such a certificate when financial assistance abuses occur, either by suspending the certificate or imposing a civil penalty. We'd like your support of this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. We support Senate Bill 135A. Let me just give you some practical examples to translate what was said by the OLCC. Right now, you can't, in effect, buy a bar. If you do, you can lose your license, you can get sanctioned, you can basically have fines levied against you. That applies to everybody. The fines and everything apply to everybody except for an out-of-state manufacturer of distilled spirits. So what happens if somebody's caught and it's an out-of-state manufacturer? The retailer can get punished, but the one who instigated the whole thing, the out-of-state manufacturer, can't be punished. Or the punishment becomes what's called the death penalty. In other words, the OLCC can basically say, we're not going to import your liquor now. What this does is give the OLCC a little more flexibility in how they sanction somebody. So, for example, it's not just the retailer who gets punished for a particular violation of statute. It's, as they said, it's the missing link right now that we don't have in the statute. It will give them a little more flexibility and not make the death penalty basically the only avenue the OLCC can take. So we would urge your support.
Thank you. You know, relating to alcoholic beverages and liquor that people consume, and it says you have to have a specific license to import it, except as, and then we've added grain and ethyl alcohol for scientific, pharmaceutical, manufacturing, mechanical, or industrial use under a certificate of approval issued by the commission. That's a lot of stuff going on there. We import things right now for fuel, I'd imagine. Is this going to open any doors or close any doors or cause any problems relating to fuel that comes from something other than petroleum or oil base? What's going on here with this the section E, subsection section 3, subsection E, line 24 on the first page? There's a lot of stuff in there, Tom. Why don't you just kind of share?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I can, and I'll try my best here. That the A and Gross version of this bill incorporates an amendment that allows importers of grain and ethyl alcohol for scientific purposes to continue to do so under a certificate of approval. They were not intended to be excluded in the original bill, and so the original bill would have unintentionally had that effect, so we added that particular language back in so that they could be brought in. I think the high-tech industry and others use this kinds of products for cleaning and solvent type of issues. It's mainly used for that purpose, is my understanding.
Well, mechanical, what's that mean? For fuel? I mean, is this going to cause... It's just a lot of words.
Yeah,
a lot
Mr.
of
uses. Chair, and I don't think it has anything at all to do with fuel.
All right. That's what I wanted to hear.
That's not my understanding.
You're convinced that doesn't have anything to do with any of that. Because we have enough people regulating fuel and doing a bunch of stuff on fuel in this state, and I don't need one more department getting involved in it.
And Mr. Chair, the Liquor Control Commission certainly wouldn't want that responsibility either.
Okay. Thank you.
Believe.
Just a comment. I think most Scotch drinkers believe it is a scientific enterprise.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. And for perhaps that. You'll.
I hope you understand my concern. Any other questions of these fine people, representative?
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Paul, you answered my question because my original question was, can't we just say you can't sell your stuff here anymore? So you answered that question. How does this certificate... allow for punishment that's not the bomb where we just take the whole product away? Tell me.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cameron, essentially it's similar to a license without being a license, I guess. So in terms of a legal way to reach an organization, an entity, a legal entity, the certificate of authority means that in order to do business in the state, they need to apply for one. Once they get one and secure one, then we can go after them and reach them with administrative sanctions, et cetera, for that purpose. So they are similar to, we already have certificates of authority that other entities have to comply with and use in order to do business in the state. So this is just an area where we haven't had to do this before, but felt there's a need now.
Because I have a license or certificate to import a certain brand of alcohol, you can now sanction me with a fine?
Correct. That is correct, Representative Cameron. And just to let the committee know, I believe one violation, if you have multiple, it would be more than this, is a Category 4 violation. It's a possible 7-day suspension or... I don't know if this is the minimum or maximum. I believe this may be the maximum. $1,155 civil penalty for the first violation of this type and a 10-day suspension and $1,650 civil penalty for the second violation of this type. So we're still not talking about a whole lot of money. Well, I don't believe it is, but maybe you do. But it certainly would get.
Depends on if you get a prevailing wage or not.
We're talking about
there seems to be a lot of things coming into this.
We're talking about corporations and companies, obviously, so not an individual.
This is so far we got. Represent. Follow up if I may. I'm getting glared at again.
Well, you're not.
I just lost my train. They got me smiling here.
Well, that's good.
So what are those rules and fine schedules of fines you just cited? They're not in the bill. Are those the ones that are levied on a licensee today?
Yes.
A retail establishment, those would be the fines that I were to take this money.
Yes,
so now what you're going to say is that now you can levy those same fines on the manufacturer or importer?
Vice Chair Cameron, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cameron, if I could, you have your general fining authority in statute. You don't have a list of specific fines. The OLCC, by rule, can adopt, and they have adopted, a fine schedule. What you're doing is just giving them the authority to levy fines on these folks and do suspensions rather than just saying, sorry, you violated our law, we're not going to import your scotch. So it's sort of a lesser penalty, and it actually gives you a little more flexibility with the licensee. And you can already do it on in-state manufacturers, like Hood River is subject to this. This sort of levels the playing field.
Which makes a nice whiskey. Yes, they do. Any further questions?
I think I've heard
good people. I know for a fact.
Okay, seeing none.
Thank you very much.
Would anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 135A today? Glad to see a lot of people smiling out there today. That's good. All right, seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 135A and open the work session on Senate Bill 135A. I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair,
Representative.
Move Senate Bill 135A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves Senate Bill 135A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. And I think we've created a standard here that if it's relating to liquor, we carry it on the floor. Or unless you won't think it merits the consent calendar.
I think you should carry it.
Carry it? All right, very good. Okay. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this good bill on the floor?
I'll do it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cameron. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 135A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 140.
Mr. Chair, Committee Member, Senate Bill 140 authorizes the Real Estate Commissioner to penalize a licensed real estate property manager or a principal real estate broker if the licensee fails to produce inspection records that are related to the management of rental real estate, and also establishes a penalty of $1,000 per day with a maximum penalty of $10,000. The Real Estate Commissioner is also authorized to issue limited licenses to brokers, property managers, and sole practitioners, and also the measure removes the requirement that the publication of disciplined licensees contain the address of the licensee. The measure passed unanimously out of the Business and Transportation Committee, and the vote count on the Senate was 27-2.
All right, Lori Skillman, please. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm a manager with the State of Oregon Real Estate Agency. I've given you written testimony that provides some background on the bill, and I always like a section-by-section analysis, so that's what I do. Senate Bill 140 is the result of two different collaborative working groups that the agency put together for the complete review of our administrative rules. One was a working group for real estate brokers that included a number of different brokers with sort of diverse geographical and business backgrounds, the Oregon Association of Realtors, members of the Real Estate Board, and staff members of the agency. The second group was a group of property managers that included licensed property managers, property manager, industry association, member of the board, and agency staff. And these groups worked together for a period of about 10 months and had lots of different meetings going over the rules. One of the things that came out of those working groups were suggestions and recommendations for changes in certain pieces of legislation. We found that there were certain things that the agency couldn't do by rule, and found that those were better addressed in statute. Some of the provisions are housekeeping kinds of provisions, or what I'd call minor substantive changes to the statutes, and those would include one, it the bill deletes a requirement by the agency that we publish in our news journal names and addresses of licensees who've been disciplined, or names and addresses of licensees whose license or potential licensees whose licenses were refused. It's kind of a way to protect the individuals, not putting their addresses in there. We put their city, of course, but not the address. The second minor change is it clarifies that only a principal broker, a sole practitioner, or property manager may register a business name. The way that the statute was written, it also allowed brokers who are required to be supervised by principal brokers to have those business names, and that was never the intent, and so we just kind of cleaned that up. Another clarification was that client funds be placed in a licensed, with a licensed escrow agent. If you put funds into an escrow, it has to be with a licensee. Since we licensed those individuals, we thought the word licensed would be appropriate. And finally, the bill allows individual principal real estate brokers the ability to create an entity for the purpose of receiving commissions. I think it was in 2005 it allowed, the statute was changed to allow real estate brokers to establish a professional corporation for the purpose of receiving their commissions. Now principal brokers also have that capability. There are two substantive kinds of changes to the statute, and one is to allow the agency to issue a limited license to a license applicant. Currently, the statute allows the agency to issue limited licenses to persons who have had their licenses suspended or revoked. The purpose of that then is to allow the licensee back into performing professional real estate activity, but with limitations. For example, the licensee would be allowed to perhaps not be able to have their own clients' trust accounts. The licensee would be allowed to only work for a particular principal real estate broker and have certain supervision requirements placed on them, and so on. So there would be a limited license is just a limitation on a license. Certain applicants are close to being qualified for a real estate license, or they do qualify, but there is something that the agency has a concern about. The agency then would be able to issue a license to an applicant with some limitations placed on them. This gives the agency a little bit a greater flexibility with license applicants. The second substantive provision of the bill is an incentive to property managers to produce records that the agency requires. 2 years ago, we worked with our property manager work group, and one of the big problems that they have are the number of documents that they're required to keep. These documents are voluminous, and in fact, the statutes were amended in 2007 to allow property managers to store those records either in state or out of state. Some of our property managers that are large have corporate offices in Seattle or Chicago, and and the way that they keep records is electronically or scanning them and so on. So we worked with the property managers to be able to accommodate their business practices and business models and said, fine, you can store them wherever you want. The agency's requirement is that you produce them when we need to look at them for audit purposes or for investigation kinds of purposes. Property managers hold significant amounts of money in clients' trust accounts, particularly security deposits on rental properties, hundreds of thousands of dollars in these kinds of accounts. The agency has a need to be able to monitor those accounts, look at the bank statements, look at their financial records, and so we agreed that they could do that under certain rules that we worked with the industry group to adopt. Now the agency's in this position of saying, well, we require you to produce them. You may be keeping them in Washington or Florida or Illinois. We don't have jurisdictional access for those. How are we going to deal with this situation? And it was the industry that came up with this concept that the agency could compel a property manager through a civil penalty for lack of production. So the bill amends Chapter 696 to allow the agency to impose a civil penalty on a property manager. It's very narrowly written to property managers, not brokers in general, only for the management of rental real estate, to impose a fine on those individuals if they do not produce records that the agency requires. And the fine is $1,000 a day, and there's a cap of $10,000. Again, this legislation, these fines were supported by all members of both the broker committee and the property managers committee. That's the end of my testimony. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you. Obviously, everybody must be happy with it because you're the only one here to testify. Give me an example of a concern that the department would have for only issuing a limited real estate license. You said there may be a concern, someone may be close to getting one. What are you talking about there?
Let's say that an individual came to us and their criminal background check showed that 22 years ago they had a misdemeanor theft. And a misdemeanor theft would be, maybe it was an actual theft, and the agency looks very closely at theft or fraudulent activity. But say it was a misdemeanor theft. Well, when I worked in the district attorney's office, a misdemeanor theft was...
College kid takes Mike Schauffler's vote for Mike Schauffler sign, carries it down the street, and gets busted for stealing something and being stupid.
Well, that would be a felony, sir.
Yeah. Oh, that's a felony. Forgive me.
I was just kidding.
I should hope so.
Felony is if you took your mug of beer.
I planned that.
A theft would be something less than $100.
All right, thank you.
So a theft of a pack of cigarettes, for example.
Just some stupid, dumb thing.
But because it's theft, it's a criminal record with theft on it. Maybe it was 10 years ago and so on. Well, perhaps the agency would issue a limited license and say, well, let's do a limited license for 2 years, and because of the theft, and we don't care what it was, we will issue a limited license and not allow you to have a client's trust account. You would have to place all of your funds with an escrow agent that you receive from clients. It would be something like that.
All right. Thank you. Representative Thatcher, then Representative Edwards. Please.
Thank you. I was just curious, the penalties that you're talking about, do those go back in to fund the agency, or where do those go?
Through the chair, Representative Thatcher, all civil penalties go into the general fund.
Thank you. I think that ought to be the case. Thank you.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the penalties, the $1,000 per day, is there a time sensitivity to getting When you make a request for records, is that a really time-sensitive issue? I mean, $1,000 a day seems like a pretty big hammer. So I'm wondering, why is that much needed as a penalty?
Through the chair, Representative Edwards, we have established by administrative rule a whole set of rules on requesting records based on the legislation from last session. Our access to the records is very important. So, for example, if the agency is going to do just a routine compliance audit on a property manager, and we want to come out and see your books and records, then we would call you and give you, you know, 5 business days to get things together. We'd tell you what it is we're kind of looking at. It's not that we would be going in there because we thought that there was something wrong with the way you were doing your records or the way you were handling your money. So we would, the administrative rules actually set out timelines that are reasonable for a property manager, business owner to get records together, have people available, and so on. If the agency believes that money is missing, then the agency can require records to be produced immediately. And so, you know, we could come in and say, we need to see your bank statements for the last 3 months, and we need to see your clients' owners' ledgers, how much money do each of these owners have. And that would be based on a complaint that the agency received and so on. So if, because we've allowed them to keep their records in any manner that they choose, based on what it is that we decided those were, you get to deal with how you want to run your business. We're not going to require you to keep the last year's records on site. But you need to produce them when we ask for them. So if you don't produce those, then we have the capability of establishing that fine. That fine was actually the concept and the dollar amount came from the working group. Didn't come from the agency. They thought that was a reasonable fine. They thought that you needed to have something that very compelling. Of course, with any imposition of a civil penalty, there's always notice and opportunity of hearing, and you know we can't just issue traffic tickets. It's a whole hearings process that someone has the opportunity to go through for that. And again, it's capped at 10, but it needed to be compelling to the licensees.
I appreciate that.
On that, right, thank you, Representative. You know, the 5 days request, if it's, I mean, that is just a normal, everyday bookkeeping. If you have a business that has a history of doing business, being legitimate, and for some reason they don't comply and they're out of 5 days, do you have flexibility to say, well, we're not going to fine you $1,000? Excuse me, on the 6th day?
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. I may have to check out here for a second. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got to say, I'm just a little bit uneasy with the limited license. And, you know, as somebody that is out there, you know, I guess in the public, you know, to have people with limited licenses for some unknown reason, to me, gives me pause about my trust in the industry, I guess. Just the concept, you know. It seems to me that you would either make a determination whether somebody deserves a license or doesn't, you know. I understand there's many cases where we could have a limited license to drive or, you know, a limited license to conduct surgery. You know, I'm just, I just am struggling a little bit with the whole concept, and I know it's something you already do, but, you know, just the parameters of what would constitute a limited license could range from you know, the simple theft from 20 years ago to somebody who had their license revoked for commingling their funds or something. I don't know. And so, I mean, one instance may be much more severe than the other, and as a consumer, I have no way to know whether or not. I don't see anything in here that would disclose to me as a consumer that my real estate agent actually only has a limited license, and I don't know exactly why it's limited. So I'm just struggling a little bit with the limited license. Somebody's going to have to talk to me some more about that.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Holvey, as I said, the agency currently has this capability of issuing a limited license if someone's been revoked, and they've had that for years. And it is the agency takes licensing of its licensees very seriously, and issuing licenses in that way. When someone is going to, a license has been suspended, and now that individual is going to come back and start performing professional real estate activity, what kinds of limitations could we put on them? And these limitations are negotiated often, and they sign basically kind of a settlement that they will perform in these kinds of capabilities. Any violations of that are very serious. A limited license for an applicant is what it is that we're talking about here. Right. And if you're looking at a licensing scheme and you say, here's the criteria for obtaining a license, some of those criteria are a little bit subjective, not very many. I mean, you have to pass a test, or you have to, you know, pay a fee, or you have to do certain kinds of things. Those are very clear. Some of the things concerning criminal background checks or certain kinds of activities that the individual may have been participated in. And basically, the agency, it's either a thumbs up or a thumbs down on a license application. In some instances, where the agency is uncomfortable about issuing a thumbs up, but may, you know, they may have to, they may want to enter into an agreement with the licensee to say, we're happy to give you a license, we're concerned about this, we would like these limitations put on your license, and if we can't do that, then we will probably refuse your license. You may have a notice and opportunity for hearing on that, but we would like these limitations on your license. See how it goes for a couple of years, and so on. I would guess that the agency would probably issue maybe one or two limited licenses in a course of a year or 2 years. It very rarely used, but there are instances where we found that, boy, it'd be nice to have that capability of doing that.
Yes, I am too.
Follow up. I have a follow up on this conversation.
Okay, go ahead, Representative. Okay. Representative Holies.
No, I'm still thinking about it.
Okay, go ahead, Representative.
I've read this. I've listened to your testimony. I just want to make sure that I'm clear in my mind. So currently, the agency has the ability to issue a limited license if the licensee was already a licensee.
Correct.
Okay. And so what you're talking about now is people that are not already licensees, but they apply for a license. Right now, as it stands now, you have an up or down authority, and that's it.
Correct.
So what you would like is the ability to have some sort of discretion and say, well, you know, if for whatever reason this person doesn't meet the criteria to be licensed, you could put limitations on the license. And so it you're looking for some flexibility in there. That's just so I understand this all.
Through the chair, Representative Edwards, that's exactly correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
And I'm sorry, we just kind of opened Pandora's box here for a moment. Follow up to that. But furthermore, that you want the ability to withhold that information, though, and not share that with the consumer, is that right? So let's say, for example, I'm going to list my house. I would have no idea if they were limited, if they had a limited license, or for what reason they would have a limited license. Is that correct?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Matthews, that's correct. These limitations that we're talking about typically have to do with close supervision of the licensee by a principal broker. And the principal broker is often very closely involved in this whole process, and it is the principal broker has to supervise a real estate broker. So we would set up provisions for what does that supervision look like, what does that supervision mean, close scrutiny of you know, agreements, sales agreements, contracts, maybe even closer scrutiny than typically would be given to a broker's work. Or in the case of a principal broker, you can't have any clients' trust accounts and so on.
A limited license doesn't necessarily mean you broke the law, does it?
No.
Yeah. And then you are very, very prudent in those that do have some kind of history. I mean, if you're guilty and serve time for forging checks, you're just not going to get a license, are you? Is that correct?
Representative Schaffler, no, you would not.
Thank you.
Yes.
I mean, it's very, has to be a very minimal offense when you're young and stupid to even get near a license. Anything that rises above that, you're out. Is that correct?
Representative Schaffler, that's correct.
All right, yeah. Thank you. Any Representative Esquivel?
Yes, and I think we have a twofold situation here, and hopefully I can clarify that in the aspect that, you know, let's say that I've done something wrong and I work for Joe Schmuckacoli, the principal broker here, and I have made an error of some sort, and so they're going to make me work directly under Joe to where I am supervised to the point of where everything I do goes through Joe, period. That's the limited licensing part. Has nothing to do with whether you have a license to participate in the sale of real estate in the state of Oregon. It has to do with between you and the supervision process. I hope that clarifies that. The other one is in an applicant. Let's say I apply, there's something in my background that's of question to the agency, and it may take 2 months or so to get that information to clear it up. Well, I don't think I should be on the sideline not earning a living while whether it be bureaucracy or whatever, comes to the forefront and takes its time to get the information so I can clear up the question. Am I pretty much dead on there?
Through the chair, Representative Esquivel, as to the first part, the close supervision, that's typically the way that the agency proceeds with limited licenses so that a broker is real closely supervised, and to a specific principal broker. And the principal broker also takes on some of that responsibility to make sure that supervision goes. As to the second part, typically before we issue the limited license, we do have all the information that is available. And before we would make a determination about that, yeah. Because once we issue the license is issued. And we're just issuing a license with some limitations on it.
Has there been a history of problems with these limited licenses?
For the individuals who've had a license, gotten in some sort of trouble and then a limited license was issued? No, we have not.
All right, any further questions?
Mr. Chair? Just one quick question, and this leaves my mind, and I'm sorry, it's not even in the bill, and I've got some great friends in real estate, and so, but when you talked about theft, it kind of got me up to how much, I guess, you know, trust and honesty goes with it in giving people access to your home that you've never even met just because they're in an industry that you trust. So my question is, if somebody, and I know it's rare, but if somebody were to get arrested for a serious theft or a burglary, how do you find out, and is their license then revoked? And what kind of time are we looking at in that? Or do you not find out till recert comes? Or how's that? If you can just help me understand how that's handled. And I know that's not in this bill, but I just kind of would like to know before we move forward with it.
Through the chair, Representative Matthews, when a licensee is arrested, that's one matter, and we typically don't find out about arrests. However, if there's been a conviction, whether it's a misdemeanor or anything, the licensee is required to inform the agency after resolution of that matter. So whatever the outcome is, if there is a conviction, then they need to notify the agency, and if it is a matter that is impacts the licensee in terms of trust, honesty, fiduciary kind of concepts, then the agency can take action against that licensee. In addition, when a licensee renews, a licensee is specifically asked, has anything changed? Have you been convicted of anything? And so on, and they have to attest to that upon renewal. But they are required to let us know.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To also let this committee know, most of your, I would say most, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but most of your thefts occur in property management, not necessarily in the real estate field itself for realtors. The ones that I've run into are property managers that have access to cash. They either commingle and or they have a problem, whether it be gambling, drugs, or whatever, and they dip into those funds that do not belong to them, and then it's kind of a spiral from there on out. Usually your realtors themselves don't usually have that opportunity because it's handled either through an escrow and or a client's trust account under the supervision of a broker. If I'm a principal broker, you bring me a contract and it has that you have $2,000 earnest money, okay, where's the money? That's the first question you ask. So there is a pretty good checks and balance in the part of the principal broker and the broker. But the real problem I see with theft in our profession seems to be gravitate around the property management group.
You know, it's a lot broader than this. I mean, we have a bill that if you don't comply with your revenue laws when you come upon renewal of any license, you don't get it. We should have some database out there. When there's a renewal, you run that name on that database. If it pops up, you're out. I don't know how we do that, but you know, we catch a lot of cheaters and bad people out there that maybe need some help too. So any further questions for this nice person? All right, we probably beat the death out of that, didn't we? Was the Senate as hard on you as we have been? Well, we're better looking.
Mr. Chair, it was a pleasure to be
with some of us.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
All righty then. Would anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 140?
Good job.
Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 140 or open work session on Senate Bill 140.
And Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair,
Representative.
I'm going to go ahead and vote yes right now, but I may reserve my right to vote no on the floor.
Very good, Representative. Thank you very much. Any other comments? Is there any opposition to the motion? All right, very good. So moved. Would anyone like to carry this bill on the floor?
Obviously, I don't think we should put it on the consent calendar.
I could carry it.
Well, you're a realtor.
No, but I don't. There's no conflict of interest.
I ran into this last session, and I appreciate your effort. Yeah, you carried a bill relating to real estate realtors, and somebody came up and said, oh, we shouldn't do that anymore. Who wants to volunteer? I'll carry this bill. I do all the hard work around here. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 802.
Mr. Chair, committee member, Senate Bill 802.
Oh, we'll close the work session. I don't know if I did or not.
No,
on
140. No, you need to do that.
So close that. Open on 802.
Okay. Senate Bill 802A creates a special events distillery license that may be obtained by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Committee members, this looks very, it's almost identical to House Bill 2528, which we heard earlier, and it's up in the Senate Business Transportation Committee today. The only difference is for the special events distillery license, they must obtain the purchase of distilled liquor for special events from the commission. The measure passed unanimously out of the Business and Transportation Committee and out of the Senate with a 28-1 vote.
Okay, Mr. Irwin, you've been waiting patiently. We thought maybe Senator Bates may have come by. And I want to thank Mr. Wagner from the executive director of the Board of Tax Practitioners for sharing his cough drops with me. Go ahead. We were waiting for Senator Bates, but apparently he's not. I'm sure he's busy doing the people's work.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Irwin, Government Affairs Director with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And Senate Bill 802A engrossed, this bill would allow an Oregon distillery to conduct tastings of its distilled spirits products at special events held at a location other than the distillery premises, such as festivals, farmers markets, community events, etc. It is important to recognize that the special events license would allow only tastings. It does not allow the sale of distilled spirits by the drink or by the bottle at these events because those activities are not part of the distillery license privileges. Sales of distilled spirits by the drink are allowed only if the distillery has also obtained a full on-premises license from the commission. Sales of distilled spirits by the bottle are allowed only at the distillery or a licensed tasting facility pursuant to a distillery outlet agent agreement with the OLCC. The OLCC is currently working with distilleries on rulemaking to further clarify the number and types of tastings that can be provided to consumers at the distillery premises in order to ensure public safety while also allowing the distilleries to promote their products. If the special events distillery license is enacted, we would continue that process with regard to tastings at special events as well.
Thank you, Tom. Any questions? Mr. Irwin?
Good. So, Tom, would this allow me to go to the Pendleton Roundup and to have, like, Pendleton whiskey samples there? Is that the type of thing that this would allow Hood River Distilleries to apply for a special permit to sample their stuff at an event like that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
They can't do that today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, they could, in fact, apply for a special events distillery license to promote their product. Keep in mind that when we're talking about tastings, we're talking about less than 2 ounces, so it wouldn't be a drink, and they couldn't sell their bottles at that special event. So,
but that's what this would do.
Yes, that's
sampling.
Absolutely. They could do it at the Pendleton Roundup as one place. Certainly they would maybe want to do it.
But you could get an ounce and a half sample of good whiskey, though.
You could, sir.
That's a sample. It said less than 2 ounces.
Yeah, less than 2 ounces, I believe, is the current standard.
And it would be regulated just as if you're running a tavern, or you can't hand it out to people that are visibly intoxicated, minors.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. All the same rules would apply.
Very good. Any further questions of Mr. Irwin? Representative.
I guess it's not really a question for him, but we're going to be giving out these little samples of alcohol, but you cannot get your sample chewed. So.
What? That's true. Good point, Representative. You can't hand out free samples of chew.
Whiskey is
Yeah. Well, assuming the bill becomes a law, Representative.
Assuming.
Hasn't yet.
Assuming so.
But it's a good bill.
Yeah.
Which one?
Anyway. Anything that I support, Representative. Anyway, any further questions of Mr. Irwin? He's been very patient. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else like to speak, testify to Senate Bill 802A today? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing. Open work session, Senate Bill 802A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 802 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 802A to the floor with due pass recommendations. Any discussion on the motion?
Good bill, Mr. Chair.
Any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. And Representative Barton, would you like to carry this?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd appreciate it.
Are you old enough to get a free sample, Representative?
Here we go.
Been picked on you for
a while.
See
that one coming.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just thought I'd give you a heads up. All right, Representative Barton is going. I'm close to work session. Okay, Representative.
I had a quick question. I know we already got. It's not going to have any impact on the bill, but I just had a quick question of clarification. If we could, yeah. And that was in the testimony, in written testimony from Mr. Irwin. I noticed that they're currently working on rulemaking to further clarify a number of types of tastings. So it sounds to me like OLCC is working on putting sideboards on this so that we don't have a case where somebody can have 2 ounces of this, 2 ounces of that, and by the end of the day, they've gone through 32.
Representative, would you like me to open the work session back up and have Mr. Irwin come speak?
I think that's how I read this. I just want to make sure my interpretation is clear.
I'm going to reopen the work session and ask Mr. Irwin to come on up here and get right on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think it's a good question. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Matthews, is that who was asking the question? You were asking the question, correct? I'm sorry. I don't know the answer to that, but I believe there are limitations, absolutely. I think it's two. I can get back to the committee if you'd like me to, but I'm pretty positive that there's only two tastings that are allowed. It's a very minimal amount of tastings that are allowed so that nobody does exactly what you were talking about over a course of time, you know, imbibes and gets too much distilled spirits and defeats the purpose of the limit. So there is a limit in the amount of the number of samples that one can have at that time. And I'll be glad to email you that information. I can just call my office and they can email it to you this morning, actually. So I'd be glad to do that.
And thanks for clarifying that. And again, sorry for the delay.
And I apologize. I don't know the exact limit, but I believe it's two.
Well, just get that to Teresa here and we'll get it to everybody. It's
okay.
A great question.
Be glad to do that.
All right. Any other questions on this? Of course, we'll close the work session again and Representative Barton will carry. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 167A. Oh, 167, period.
Mr. Chair, Committee Member, Senate Bill 167 authorizes the Public Employees Benefit Board to allow nurses and nurse educators employed less than half-time by either state agency or university to participate in self-paid group benefit plans and also waives the statutory minimum participation requirement. The measure passed unanimously out of both the Senate Commerce and Workforce Development Committee and the Senate floor.
And we have Ms. Barrett here to tell us what we're doing.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. My name is Bobby Barrett, and I'm the Public Employees Benefit Board Plan Design Manager, and I'm here today to give you brief testimony in support of Senate Bill 167. Senate Bill 167 is basically a housekeeping bill that makes a technical correction to Senate Bill 4 enrolled from the 2007 legislative session. Senate Bill 4 added language to allow state-employed nurses and nurse educators to access PEB benefits, medical and dental. However, placed the language in the wrong area of the statute, which made it could not be touched by these nurses. It actually put the language into not available or not permitted or not eligible area. So Senate Bill 167 clearly states that these nurses are now eligible and there is an exception for the hours that they work as half-time, less than half-time, that they would be eligible as self-pay members for PEB medical benefits. And self-pay means that they actually pay for those benefits out of their own pocket. And they would have an exception to the number of hours that they work in order to be able to access those. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Sorry that mistake happened. Any questions? Representative.
Can anybody who is a public employee who is not a nurse or nurse educator participate in self-pay groups?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Thatcher, that has to go through statute and approval of the board. But basically, we do have some self-pay groups, such as the Department of Human Services foster parents, and we also have the blind school employees that participate as self-pay.
Any further questions? All right. Well, thank you very much. Would anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 167 today? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 167, open a work session on Senate Bill 167. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 167 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 167 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? I imagine, Representative, if they can self-pay their pension, then maybe they should be able to self-pay their supplemental insurance. Yeah, probably a good question. Any other comments other than the one I just made? Any opposition to the motion? All right, seeing none, so moved. Would anyone like to carry this bill, or should we put it on the consent calendar? What was the vote?
It was unanimous.
30-0.
Both.
30-0. All right. Put it on the consent calendar.
All right, so be it. We'll put it on the consent calendar. Close the work session on Senate Bill 167. And I want to thank these good people for their patience today. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 172.
Mr. Chair, Committee Member, Senate Bill 172 extends the State Board of Tax Practitioners license requirement to persons who prepare for compensation, corporate tax returns, partnership tax returns, S-corporation tax returns, trust tax returns, and estate tax returns. The measure passed unanimously out of the Senate Business Transportation Committee and out of the Senate floor with a 26-4 vote. Members, you have in your packet today a revenue statement on the ingress measure in which the impact is minimal.
Mr. Wagner, thank you for the cough drops. I greatly appreciate it. Very thoughtful of you.
You ready?
Whenever you're ready.
Great. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Wagner. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Tax Practitioners. I'm going to provide testimony this morning regarding Senate Bill 172 to expand the board's authority. Currently, the board has jurisdiction over anyone who prepares taxes in the state of Oregon for a fee for another person, but that only applies to those who prepare personal income tax returns. Does not cover anyone who prepares any other type of entity of return other than personal income tax returns. We are a consumer protection agency. Our agency has been in effect for 36 years. Interestingly, we are the only state with an active program to test and license tax preparers in the nation. We are recognized nationally as a model to other states for federal licensing program. We do a great job of what we do, but we believe we can do better. That's why we're here to propose this bill to be able to expand who we have jurisdiction over. There are cases where consumers, taxpayers, are not served well because those who prepare the corporate or partnership return, possibly a trust or estate, may not be knowledgeable or competent to do so. We don't believe that instances where they make errors are necessarily willful negligence. We believe frequently it may be honest mistakes. We in other states, as well as the U.S. Senate, see the importance and benefits that are currently realized by personal income tax consumers in Oregon with the jurisdiction of the board, and we'd just like to expand that. The U.S. Government Accountability Office in August of 2008 released a report to the Committee on Finance of the U.S. Senate. And this is actually a copy of the report, and what is was incredible to me is to see that the recognition they gave to the state of Oregon. It says on the very cover of the report to the U.S. Senate, it says, Oregon's regulatory regime may lead to improved federal tax return accuracy and provides a possible model for national regulation. And I just point that out to show how highly regarded Oregon's program is on what we do and how we protect consumers for personal income tax returns. The report shows that we do serve the consumer better with more accurate returns.
if I can read, just take a minute of your time, read a couple excerpts out of this report. It says, according to GAO's analysis of the IRS tax year 2001 National Research Program data, Oregon returns were more likely to be accurate compared to the rest of the country after controlling for other factors likely to affect accuracy. They found that the odds that a return filed by an Oregon paid preparer were accurate were about 72% higher than the odds for a comparable return filed by a paid preparer in the rest of the country. In dollar terms, the average Oregon return required approximately $250 less of a change in tax liability than the average return in the rest of the country. For Oregon's 1.7 million individual tax filers, this equates to over $390 million more in federal income tax paid in Oregon than would have been paid if the returns were as accurate as similar returns in the rest of the country. It says, if Congress judges that the Oregon paid preparer regulatory regime is likely to account for at least a moderate portion of the higher accuracy of Oregon federal returns and could be implemented nationwide at a favorable cost compared to the potential benefits of improved accuracy, it should consider adopting a similar regime nationwide. So we do believe that this bill will serve consumers better by expanding to entities beyond just the personal income tax returns, and we believe also that it will help to close the tax gap, meaning more dollars to the state general fund. We look at this bill not as a hammer to hold over their heads. It's really simply allows to require initial competence and some continuing education in those areas. We believe the GOA report backs this up. Combination of testing for initial licensing and requiring ongoing yearly continuing education improve the accuracy of returns filed, which increases money to the general fund. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
You know, I was surprised when I talked to you in my office about this. Anybody could do this, regardless of whether they're competent or not.
They can. Representative Schaffler, you're exactly correct. Anyone can hang their shingle and prepare a corporate return, a partnership return, trust or estate, which are certainly not easy returns to do. They can do so because they're not licensed at all.
Do you think that, are there any estimates? We're probably missing out on some revenue, and I'd imagine these customers may be getting stung with penalties if it's not done correctly. Do you see a positive revenue impact due to this? People paying their taxes, not the fees, but the tax payment?
Yeah. Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, we don't have any data that would, to back that up, we do believe, similar to with the personal income tax program and the benefits that have been shown to Oregon, certainly to the state general fund, due to regulation of personal income tax returns, we certainly anticipate we would receive some of the same benefits if with these rules applying to corporations and partnerships.
I would like you to remember, if I'm here 2 years from now, to tell me how much that is.
We would certainly seek to look for ways to be able to measure that.
Great. Representative Edwards and Representative Matthews.
Thank you. I have a couple of clarifying questions. So currently, you said anybody can hang out their shingle to prepare, say, corporate tax returns, and that's true that they could do that and charge for that?
Yes, they can.
Okay. And so the state law does not require that it has to be a practitioner or a CPA. I mean, just anybody could do that.
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
So my line of questioning and this report, I'd actually like to get a full copy of the report because I have not been, it's no secret, I made this clear in the general government subcommittee. I have not historically been supportive of your agency's existence. And I was told last session that Oregon was literally the only state that had a split between CPAs and tax practitioners, and it just never made sense to me. You might be able to not only get me to yes on this bill, but get me to yes on the existence of your agency through going over that report. That sounds interesting to me. It sounds interesting. Having not seen the report yet, I won't be supporting the bill today. But I'd like to talk to you some more about it. So,
Great.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some angst with this bill, and I guess it's because, and the way it's being presented now is that anybody can do this, and I want to share with you, too, to the committee and for anybody out there, that I have a constituent in my district, 35 years corporate tax experience, 20-plus year member and past president of the Portland Chapter of Tax Executive Institute, Oregon Public Accounting license held since July of 73 through June of 07. This bill would not allow him to do any tax consulting because he's non-licensed. His license lapsed as a result of his retirement. However, this individual's been called and been utilized as a resource to Louisiana Pacific Corporation in preparing their nearly 80 federal, state, and local income taxes due to maternity leave that they didn't suspect was going to happen. He's also been, a resource to South Carolina and many other states in the field of corporate. I agree that the public needs competent, licensed people preparing tax returns, but it seems like this bill potentially eliminates some of those folks that may be the most competent and the most experienced. And so having that, I see where somebody's license may have lapsed in 07, and now here they are in 09 being told that basically you've got a tremendous amount of talent, a great deal of experience, we appreciate all your work. I mean, for over 30 years, a dedicated employee of Willamette Industries, and this guy's being cast aside as not being able to help, assist, prepare advice on taxes because, as you said, community's not being served well. And I disagree with that, and I'm just curious what your response to that would be.
Oh, we saved the interesting bill for last, didn't we?
And I wouldn't have suspected it either. I mean, you could have woke up my head sewn to the carpet. I wouldn't be more surprised than this. So.
Right. Go ahead.
Chair Schaffer, Representative Matthews. What this bill is seeking to do is just to assure that anyone who does prepare for a fee and provides a service to someone is competent. So this person certainly is not precluded from providing services to someone. Taking advantage of their 30 years of experience is a wonderful thing. What we simply want to do is to make sure that they are competent, which we do with our current licensees. They pass a competency exam, and they have continuing education hours each year. As I'm sure all of you know from your own personal income tax filings, tax law is not a static thing. Tax law, whether it's personal income tax or corporate tax law, changes on a yearly basis, federal laws as well as Oregon laws, and so our continuing education requirement is there to make sure that people can keep up with the ever-changing tax laws. We would want someone who, even though they've got 30 years of experience, to make sure that they don't remain static, that they continue to be updated on the most recent tax laws that have been passed by federal as well as Oregon. In this case, I would assume they could probably very easily pass competency exam and could very easily get the continuing educational hours each year.
And as follow-up.
Please, go ahead.
And then what's the fee assigned with this license that would be required?
Chair Schaffer, Representative Matthews, the fee has not been set yet. It would be set by rule. Currently, the fee that is charged for a consultant is $95 per year, and for a tax preparer is $85 per year. So it certainly would be in lines with that.
Could someone... Are you finished, Representative?
I just have one last.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. And I'll close it by saying that this is a bill that I was notified early on about. Had spent some time on the phone, some time in emails, exchanging some dialogue about a way, well, if this were to get through the Senate, how could it be amended to include or to allow these folks that, quite honestly, and there's a lot of them out there, and this generation of retirees that are still available as a resource, aren't necessarily interested in doing everything when they have this concise area of expertise. A lot of folks can go in and get this license today and not have that expertise in the field, but they could still get your license and be qualified by this bill. So I'll just close it with this, Mr. Chair, and this is the last email that I had after, again, several efforts on how we could amend this, and it says, this is from him. I cannot think of anything that could easily be added to modify this bill that would allow non-licensed individuals to prepare, advise, or assist in preparation of tax returns. Kind of a waste of my experience and a waste of my talents. Love, Dad. It's my father, John Hammond. So, you know, a man that I have a great deal of respect for, a man that dedicated so much of his life to Willamette Industries and dedicated a great deal of his life to me. So that's, it is personal for me, but it's also knowing a lot of these folks in that industry and a lot of his friends that are now all of a sudden not going to be utilized as a resource. Quite honestly, they're the only group I know that gets excited about tax season. So, and it's because their phone rings and they're needed again. And I need my dad every day, don't get me wrong, but this is just one of those bills that I think is a slap in the face to some of those folks that have a lot to still offer.
Mr. Chair.
Before I go to Representative Holvey and then to Barton and then to Kennerman, my brother, I have the best accountant in the world, Ed Hodgson. He is just, we have the best accountant. And my brother passed his CPA test years ago and then prepared taxes for a season with Ed. He still hasn't got a CPA license. He has to go through that apprenticeship, if you will, first. I don't know if he'll ever do that, but he's a business person and has incredible knowledge as well. But he didn't have his license, yet he could prepare under someone who did. Could Representative Matthew's father work under someone and give advice who does have a license? And I don't know if that's the scenario he was talking about right there. How's that work out? Because when my brother retires, he's going to want to do something. He's not going to sit around paying and let him sit around the house. She won't even let him run for the legislature like my generous wife does. But is there a scenario where we would not lose out on that that experience and that we wouldn't? Because that is a wealth of knowledge, and I don't want to just brush that off the table. How is this all working out for us?
Chair Schaffler, under the current provisions of the bill, they would not. It does require licensing of anyone who prepares taxes in Oregon, just as it does for personal income tax currently. We do have two levels of licensure. Currently, we have preparers who must work under the supervision of a consultant. But whether you're a consultant or a preparer, both of those are licensed practitioners. So the bill would require that they do be licensed and show their competency through their continuing ed each year.
Now, we're just going to see what happens here. Representative Holvey, then Representative Barton, then Representative Kennerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I respect the comments by Representative Matthews. I've dealt with some other licensing industries that have had that same issue where you have some people that have been in the industry a long time but have never really been licensed to do certain things, and they have the experience, but and I appreciate that, and but I've always recognized that if a person really wants to, even though they're retired from the industry or something, they do have the ability to get licensed. Nothing's standing in their way of doing that, and usually there are, many industries, I don't know that this one's the case, but they do, get credit for their life experiences as well. But on the flip side of all of that, at the same time, I think it's pretty imperative that we don't have people out there doing things that really aren't qualified and putting consumers or businesses at risk for doing things incorrectly as well. So I mean there's a balance there and a trade-off certainly, but I'm supportive of this myself. Thank you.
Before I go on to my colleagues again, in the scenario I just spelled out, you have an individual who has extensive history in business, a degree in finance, and has went through and taken the courses, passed their CPA test, currently is doing the required work under several areas of tax law to qualify for their CPA license, and they are working for a licensed certified public accountant and helping them prepare taxes. That individual would have to go in and get a practitioner's license to do that.
Chair Schaffler, the provisions for the Board of Tax Practitioners specifically excludes those who are licensed as a CPA or work for a CPA. So this the provisions of the statutes that regulate the Board of Tax Practitioners only covers those who are not CPAs, work for CPAs, or work as an employee of a corporation, of a company.
And then
so this is really for standalone folks.
So it would not relate to Representative Matthews' father, then?
If he is a CPA and his license is current as a CPA, then this bill would not cover him.
What if the industry that he's working for and consulting with has their own licensed CPA within that corporation, and he goes out of retirement and works with them for a little while? For the reason he spelled out,
right.
Some maternity leave or sick leave pops up right at tax season.
Right. And Chair Schaffler, if they were working as an employee of that CPA firm, or under that CPA, then again they would be excluded under other provisions of this bill.
Representative Barton, then Representative Kanemer.
Pass.
Representative Kanemer, please.
A couple of thoughts about that. You said an exception would be licensed under, or that if they were in a corporation.
Correct.
I'm thinking about an instance a few years ago where we had some pretty complicated returns on some investments and involved trusts and several different types of corporations. We ended up having to have that portion of our tax prepared by an attorney, which was kind of an unpleasant surprise. No offense intended. Expensive.
That we know.
Expensive, may I add. And I guess I'm wondering, is that person excluded? And the other is, are you going to amend your testing forms? It seems like, you currently don't examine for these kinds of specialties. And these are specialties, and is there going to be a separate license? And I see no provisions for that. It seems like you're requiring these specialists to be licensed with a general license.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Kanemer, regarding the first question that you posed, asking about if someone is an attorney, again, those are excluded under the general provisions of statute now. So anyone who is an attorney, they're regulated by the Oregon State Bar, therefore they are not subject to the jurisdiction of our board. That hopefully answers your first question. The second one is, we do not have any specific provisions in Senate Bill 172 regarding the testing of these. That would be done by rule. Our board of directors, we've got 7 board of directors with oversight of our board. We'll be meeting, they'll be meeting next week with us, and we'll be talking further about this, how this exactly will be implemented, whether, I think there are all sorts of questions. Do we grandfather folks in who have been preparing returns for quite some time, allow them to simply show the continuing education, that they meet the continuing education requirements each year? Do we add testing? There are a number of our current licensees who do not prepare corporate or partnership returns, trust or estates, and so we don't see that it would be in the best interest to add to the testing questions on those areas where they don't prepare returns. So it could be some kind of an addendum or an additional test for people to take if they want to be licensed to prepare corporate partnership, trust or estate returns.
Further question, I guess, does the bill authorize rulemaking broad enough that you can grandfather if your board so chooses?
Chair Schaffler and Representative Kanemer, we believe that it does.
Folks, I'm not going to work this today, Mr. Wagner. Out of fairness to my colleagues and to you, I think you have some work to do. I think we can get from here to there. You have at least 2 members that have family members with decades. My brother's been at this for 30, almost 40 years, and I have no idea how long Representative Matthews' father's at it, so I think you just need to do a little work on this with them. I really want to make this easy. And we have an attorney here. I don't know if he's ever done tax. Well, Representative.
No, Mr. Chair, but Representative Matthews' father is my constituent. So.
Well, then we're
double whammy.
Just for clarification, I have the good fortune of being raised by 2 sets of parents, so I have one father that is his constituent and this father who is my constituent.
Never mind, I'm fine with the bill then.
Well, either way, I just think we need to talk about this a little longer, and I think we can get from here to there. Representative Witt, then Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As this bill is worked on, if it is
hope folks have paid some attention to those individuals who volunteer at tax time to assist college students on various campuses, as well as the elderly.
Senior centers, that's right. Thank you.
Well, I really thought it was going to be easier. Representative Thatcher.
This is not a question, but it seems to me like I heard a wise representative say on the floor the other day that you can only be a leader if others follow. I think that was you. Yeah, it was. And it looks like after 36 years of having this law in place, we're still the only ones doing it for personal tax preparers. And now we're looking at even expanding it to in the name of consumer protection. The consumers in this case are businesses. So anyway, just an observation.
Okay. Any further questions of Mr. Wagner? And he will be coming around. I'm sure we'll see him soon. I appreciate your effort, Mr. Wagner. Just see what we do.
Great. Thank you for your time.
Anything else today?
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 172, and I would entertain a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Edwards and Representative Barton to vote on specific bills.
Representative, you move to suspend the rules.
Mr. Chair, I'll move to suspend the rules so that
Edwards and Barton
to allow Representative Edwards and Barton to vote on Senate Bill 135 for Representative Barton and Senate Bill 81 and Senate Bill 83 for Representative Edwards.
Representative Cameron moves to suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Edwards to vote on Senate Bill 81 and Senate Bill 83 and Representative Barton to vote on Senate Bill 135. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, Representative Edwards, how do you vote on Senate Bill 81?
Aye.
Senate Bill 83?
Aye.
Very good. Representative Barton, how do you vote on Senate Bill 135?
Aye.
Very good. And then, Teresa, did you have anything else?
No, I do not.
Does anyone have anything else for the good of the order? All right, they are adjourned.